I want to do two chapters. I think I can do two chapters. I'm going to really hurry through some of the stuff, but I want to read a bunch of it. The first chapter, 24, I mean, there's not much in there that I want to cover. I'm not saying there's not much in there to know. I'm just saying there's not much in there I want to cover. And so I want you to trust me on that. Chapter 24 and 25 are one unit. They go together. And as I've been trying to do as much as possible, is cover the units as I can in big chunks. And I want to do this. What I want you to see here, and if you're familiar with the text, the idea that this is somehow prophetic into our future is debatable, and that's a matter of interpretation. It was future when Jesus said it. There's no debate on that, okay? So the text that we're reading this morning was written after the crucifixion of Christ, all right? And in anticipation, then, of his second coming. All right, you following this? The first coming of Christ is when he came to earth and died on the cross. But to the disciples, until Jesus actually died and rose again, they have no clue that there's going to be a second coming. There is no second coming of Christ in their heads. They expected Jesus not to die on the cross and to set up a kingdom. Very, very important to understand that as you read this text, because it only makes sense if you know these things. So, if you remember last week, Jesus was talking to the Pharisees and he put all these woes against them. These are the bad things that are coming to Israel because of their rejection of the Messiah. Chapters 24 and 25 continue that idea. Jesus left the temple and was going away. So they've just had this conversation with the scribes and the Pharisees. They're leaving. When his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple, but he answered them, "You see all of these? Truly I say to you, there will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." Wow. Okay, so it's all going to be trashed. Now, put yourself in the mind of the disciples for just a minute. Jesus has just told them that the destruction of the temple is going to happen. But he's the Messiah, right? He's going to come and set up this kingdom and reign and overthrow the Romans. This is their idea. But he's saying, nope, it's all going to be trashed. A little bit of a difficulty for them. And he sat on the Mount of Olives. The disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, what are you talking about? When are these things going to be? When is this all going to be destroyed? And what will be the sign of your coming and the close of the age?" So now that when they say, "What will be the sign of your coming?" they mean, when are you setting up this kingdom? Because it's getting real old here. All right? They were nervous. They could see the writing on the wall. Now Jesus is saying, the temple's going to be destroyed? The only way that would happen is if everything is destroyed in Israel. They're saying, so tell us about when this kingdom's really going to happen here. So many misunderstand the disciples' question. They then, if you misunderstand this question, you misunderstand the entire passage. When the disciples asked, "Tell us, when will these things be and what will be the sign of the coming and the close of the age?" they're not asking about his second coming. They're asking about his first coming. His first coming is kingdom. Now, we run into this, and I'm going to tell you right now, it's very, very typical for people to interpret Matthew 24 and 25 as something in our future, just before the tribulation and so forth and so on. And thus, since there's no temple there now, there needs to be a temple rebuilt for a temple to be destroyed and so forth and so on. And I will tell you, that is an interpretation that many hold to. I don't. I don't hold to that interpretation. I believe the second coming of Christ could happen at any time. I don't think we need any time to create a temple or anything else. All right? So the other thing that I want to point out is I don't think that there's anything in Matthew 24 and 25 that needs to be interpreted as some, I mean, so to speak, you'll see what I mean when I go through it, as a future thing that needs to still be achieved in terms of prophecy. In other words, everything Jesus says here already happened, except for like the end of the age, the theological or the eschatological day of the Lord. And I'll cover that when I get to it. So basically, what are the disciples asking? They're asking this. If the Messiah is like reigning, Jesus, how does the temple get destroyed? That is the real question in their minds, which is a good question. In other words, what kind of Christ is going to allow the temple to be destroyed? What kind of Christ will let that happen? The disciples were asking about Christ's first coming without any clue about a second coming at all. They didn't believe in a second coming at this point. His disciples were still thinking in terms of an earthly kingdom. And we have to keep this in mind when reading these chapters. It helps us understand that throughout chapter 24, Jesus is outlining events that would transpire in the realm of earthly kingdoms, but they were not to be mistaken with what was happening in his spiritual kingdom. So now you can see what chapters 24 and 25 are about. They're about these things will happen in earthly kingdoms, but my spiritual kingdom will have these things happening in them. And that's it. So no matter what happens in earthly kingdoms, it doesn't affect what's happening in my kingdom. And that's what he wants his disciples to understand. Jesus answered them, "See that no one leads you astray, for many will come in my name saying, 'I am the Christ,' and they will lead many astray." So Jesus is warning them about following any other Christ. And we think, you know, people always do this today, thinking about, oh, is there another Christ? How could you make that mistake? Okay, let's just go back to what we've already covered in the book of Matthew, and it'll be clear. Jesus is saying, no other Christ is coming, nor should he be followed. Now, do you remember John the Baptist when he was in prison, and he sends his disciples to Jesus and says, "Are you the one, or should we expect another?" See, that's the nature of the statement Jesus is making now. It's the same question of interpretation that people had in Isaiah, that John had and other people thought. They could read Isaiah and they could say, we have this description here of this reigning Messiah, and we have this description of the suffering servant of the Lord, and we just can't put them together. And so they thought there must be two, a suffering servant and a reigning servant. One, and Jesus is saying, no, there's only one, and it's me, and I will do both. Just not in the time frame that you're expecting. And Jesus is saying here, he is the one and only Son of God. Don't, even if I die, don't expect another Christ that will come and reign. I am the same one. I am the only one. Then he says, "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not alarmed, for this must take place. But the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All of these are the beginnings of birth pangs. And then they will deliver you up to tribulation and put you to death, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will fall away and betray one another and hate one another, and many false prophets will arise and lead many astray. And because lawlessness will be increased, the love of many will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end will be saved." And the yellow part here, "And this gospel of the kingdom will be proclaimed throughout the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." So what's this whole section about? Jesus is just saying bad things are going to happen. Okay? Bad things are going to happen, but the good news of Christ's kingdom will go into all the nations before the final end comes. That's it. That's the whole point. Next section. I told you I'm going to go through this first part quickly. You see, you don't need to go, oh, there's wars in the world. There's always been wars in the world. You get two people on the planet, there's going to be fighting, right? It's as simple as that. "So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is on the housetop not go down to take what's in his house, and let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant or for those who are nursing infants in those days, pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath." Point of that one is, that's the fall of Jerusalem. That happened. It's over. This is not a future thing that's going to happen in Israel. Some people make that interpretation. If that's your interpretation, you're happy to keep it. I'm just telling you, it doesn't have to be future. Okay? It happened when the Romans went in AD 70 and destroyed Jerusalem. It already happened. If you want to look at the future, the difficulty of putting in the future is, why does Jesus care about the Sabbath then? Okay? Jesus is just saying the fall of Judea is coming. He's answering the disciples' question about when it's all going to be torn down. Some people say that there's both a past and a future reference. I leave that to you. It's not necessary to believe that, though, in order to have the interpretation of the passage. Up to you. So, the key thing here is the gospel will go out. Now, the next section is about the preservation of the gospel. For then there will be great tribulation, such as not been from the beginning of the world until now, and no, never will be. And if those days had not been cut short, no human being would be saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. This is talking about the preserving of the gospel, that even though Jerusalem will fall, again, this is my interpretation of the text. You can take a different one. Some people will put this as the Great Tribulation, the seven-year period, and the end times. I don't do that. I don't think it's necessary to do that. Jesus is just saying, even though Jerusalem is going to fall and these bad things are going to happen, it's not going to destroy my church. The elect will continue to be alive, and my church and the gospel will continue. That's all I believe he's saying here. Then if anyone says to you, look, here's the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and perform great signs and wonders so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. So if they say to you, look, he's in the wilderness, don't go out there. If they say, look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and shines as far as the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. Very interesting way to wrap that text up, Jesus, talking about vultures. The point is the section that I highlighted in yellow. Okay? The point is, when Jesus returns, you're not going to miss it. The second coming. When Jesus comes at the end of the age, you won't miss it. Nobody will miss it. It won't be the secret thing that just some people find out about it and everybody else is still wondering. When Jesus comes back at the end of the age, everybody will see it. He's saying his coming will be unmistakable. This reiterates the previous thoughts in verses 4 to 14, and is not about the destruction of Jerusalem. The point here is the coming of Christ will be unmistakable. The vulture reference here, nobody knows what this means, all right? There's theories on what it means, but nobody can say they know beyond a shadow of a doubt what it means. It either speaks to judgment or is a proverb about obviousness, which is likely what it means. For example, while we were in Canada, we were kayaking down the river, and for the first time in my life, I saw a group of turkey vultures circling something. I'd never seen that before. I've seen it on TV and in cartoons and everything like that, but I had never seen it, because I, of course, don't live in the desert where, of course, the vultures live. But here I was in Canada, and we watched turkey vultures. There were three of them circling. And because they were circling, what did I know? I knew something that I could not see, but I knew something was there. I knew there was something dead or dying on the ground because the vultures told me so. It's most likely that's what that phrase means. You will see the sign and you will know what's going on. It'll be obvious to you. And then Jesus speaks of the day of judgment. This is the eschatological day of judgment. Eschatological is a fancy word that theologians use to mean the last days. Okay? And it's the big day of judgment that's spoken about in the Old Testament. So throughout the prophets in the Old Testament, the day of the Lord is coming and there's going to be these signs. The sun and the moon will be darkened and turned to blood and so forth. Very, very common in the Old Testament. And Jesus says this here. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. All the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will not miss this day, okay? And they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. All nations will mourn that day. Do you know why? They will know they were wrong. It will be unmistakable and clear, and all the earth will know. As verse 14 said, the gospel will go out as a testimony to all nations. They will have heard it. And when Christ returns, they will mourn their not responding to it. And Christ will take his own out of this world. And so he says, be ready. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts out its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also when you see all these things, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Now, this generation is a very important thing because some people, if it's eschatological future, and people say, well, we saw Israel gathered in 1947, so therefore the people alive today, and then they start, so, well, how long is a generation? Well, a generation's 40 years. Oh, but we're running out of time, so let's extend that. And you get all these people running around with theories about when Jesus is supposed to return. No, it's none of those things. Jesus is just saying that the distress that he speaks of will begin in the lifetime of his disciples. The things that I mentioned to you about the destruction of Jerusalem and fall, it's going to happen in your lifetime, this generation. That's all he's speaking about here. Even so, the rest of his words, the future return of Christ, the second coming, they also would return. So it's very common in prophecy to have this will happen to verify the unknown thing that will happen later. So you see signs in the Old Testament that Ezekiel or Jeremiah or Isaiah will do. They'll say, this word that's going to happen later on, maybe 100 years down the road or far down the road, out of our lifetimes, the way I can prove this will happen is I will give you a sign now. And so the sign now is the gives the authentication of the future promise. It's essentially what's happening here. Verses 35 and 36. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But concerning that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father only. So Jesus' words will come to pass, but only God knows when, right? Only God the Father knows when that will be. So these people running around, the first time, well, not the first time, but I remember a book came out in 1987 or so. It was 88 Reasons Why Jesus Will Return in 1988. And he kept revising it year after year with new information. He doesn't know. These people run around. We had one last year. Remember last? No, was this? Was it last year? Was it this year? I don't remember when it was, and the people were running around, and they got all this press, and you just make us all look stupid. Please, don't do that. All right. As were the days of Noah, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. For as in those days, before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day when Noah entered the ark, and they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. So will be the coming of the Son of Man. What does this mean? It just means life is just going to go on like usual until he comes. There's not going to be anything that's going to be, oh, we're at the countdown of days. You're just going to, and the whole world is just going to go on living just like every day after every day, and then, bam, he'll show up. There's not going to be something that will set it off. He says, then two men will be in the field, one will be taken and one left. Two women will be grinding at the mill, one taken and one left. What's he saying here? The day will come unexpectedly. It'll happen on a day just like any other. People will be out working the field, grinding the mill, making their bread, going to work, buying and selling. That's the kind of day it'll be. It won't be the day that you think it's going to be. It'll be a day just like today, or tomorrow, or yesterday, just like any other day. That's all he's saying. But he wants his disciples to expect it and be ready. It will come, but you won't know when. So be ready for it. And that's all he wants. What was foremost on his mind? Well, let me read this first. Therefore, stay awake, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming. But know this, that if the master of the house had known in what part of the night the thief was coming, he would have stayed awake and would not have left his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also must be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. I had a kid in college, he used to walk around saying, you expect Jesus to come today? I don't, because he's going to come at an hour I don't expect. So if I don't expect him now, he will come today. Okay. But what is foremost on Jesus' mind is this: how his disciples would treat one another in his absence while they waited for the return of the king. So chapter 24 is about all the things that will transpire in the nations while Jesus until Jesus comes back. The fall of Jerusalem, wars, fighting, day like any other, on and on and on and on. That's going to be earthly kingdoms. And chapter 25 says, but in my kingdom, this is what I expect. And this is the part of the sermon that's really important. That's why I hustled through that part, because I really don't care. Even if you want to say that's all future eschatology, I don't care, because it's not going to affect you, really. Just be ready. This next part does affect you, because it's all about how you're supposed to treat one another in the kingdom while you're waiting for Christ to return. And we get some really good stuff here now. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom his master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants, and eats and drinks with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces, and put him with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Again, kind of a creepy story, but what's the point? Anyone who abused members of the kingdom would find, in the end, you're not part of it. That's all Jesus is saying. You think you're in the kingdom. You're running around pretending to be in the kingdom. You got some position that looks like it's in the kingdom. But in the end, if you mistreat other people in the kingdom, you're not in the kingdom. There's a behavioral requirement for all those in the kingdom, and it's to care for the others in the kingdom. This one was supposed to be feeding and caring. And he did the opposite of Jesus' value system. Instead of sacrificial love for the benefit of others, he exploited the others in the kingdom. He was never in it. How we treat the members of the kingdom reveals whether or not we're truly in it. If you're in God's kingdom, you will treat all members of the kingdom with sacrificial love. You can't separate your personal beliefs from the actions that flow from them. You will live your value system. And if the value system you live is not the one of the kingdom, you aren't part of it. Then Jesus tells another story, the parable of the 10 virgins. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. So these are ladies who would be waiting for the bridegroom to arrive before the feast. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. That would be extra oil. But the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight, there was a cry, here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterward, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered, truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour. So again, we have another thing that talks about not knowing the day and the hour, the importance of being ready for the return of Christ. In particular, in this story, Jesus is teaching his disciples to be prepared while they wait for the king. What's the point here? He's saying, be ready for as long as it takes. Don't give up. Those who are prepared can't help those who aren't prepared. That's the point. Waiting for the king is an individual responsibility. I can't wait for you. My faith won't save you. You can't make others ready for the king. You can only make sure you are ready. And the foolish virgins thought that waiting would be easy, and they failed to enter the kingdom. Now, there's another story, for it will be, and he's talking about the coming there. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted to them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, each according to his ability. I could draw 3 people out here and make you feel bad, but I won't use you in my illustrations this morning. Then he went away. The one who had received 5 talents went off and he used them, he invested them, he traded them, and he made 5 more. The one who was given 2 made 2 more. And the one who had received 1 talent dug a hole in the ground and put the money there. When the master returned, he invited his servants in to see how they performed. The one who had received 5 said, hey, I doubled your money. I made 5 more. And the master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. The same thing happened with the guy who got 2. He doubled the money, and the master said the same thing to him. Then the guy who had received 1 talent came in. And he said, Master, I knew you were a hard man. He really knows how to butter this guy up. I knew you were a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here is it back. It was yours, and I give it to you. And in my house, we would say, fail. His master said to him, you wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I'm this hard man. You could at least put it up for receiving interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has more will be given and he will have an abundance. But the one who has not, even what he has will be taken from him. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place, there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So God expects us to work while we wait for the king. Doing nothing in the kingdom implies that you don't trust the master. Waiting for the coming of the king requires that we be active, advancing the kingdom while we wait for his return. That's what he's talking about. You're extending his kingdom. If you do nothing to extend his kingdom, we learned before, one of the signs of being in the kingdom is you point people to the king, you tell people the kingdom, you help to extend the kingdom in some way. Doing nothing in the kingdom implies that you don't trust the master and you're probably not even in the kingdom. The wicked servant did nothing because he thought serving the master was too difficult. He was paralyzed by fear and unbelief. Now, let's look at these 2 stories here, the foolish virgins and the wicked servant. Let's put them together. You see the difference in these? They both failed. Some portion of the people in the stories failed and some succeeded. The foolish virgins failed because they thought waiting was going to be easy. And the wicked servant failed because waiting was going to be too difficult. It's neither. It's just being about what you need to be about in the kingdom. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and all the angels with him. Then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right and the goats on the left. Then the king will say to those on his right, "Come, you who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you welcomed me. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." And the righteous will say, "When did that happen?" And Jesus will say, "Whenever you did it to one of those in the kingdom, you did it to me." And then he will say to those on the left, "Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry and you gave me nothing. I was thirsty and you gave me nothing. I was a stranger and you didn't invite me in. I was naked and you didn't help me. I was sick and you didn't help me. I was in prison and you didn't help me." And they'll say, "I don't remember any of that happening to you, Jesus." And he will say, "You didn't do it to those in the kingdom, so you didn't do it to me." And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. What's the difference between the sheep and the goats? How you treat people in the kingdom. That's it. God will look at you based on how you treat people in the kingdom. Now, of course, I know we're saved by faith in the blood of Christ. You know I teach all that stuff. But Jesus, when he invites you into the kingdom, expects you to do what? Adopt the value system of the kingdom. Otherwise, how can you say, "I know somebody," if you don't know their values? So when Jesus says, "I never knew you," to people, he's saying, "You didn't know me back. We don't share a common value system." How you treat members of the kingdom reflects on whether or not you're in it. If you're in the kingdom, you will treat others in the kingdom with love. You will just do it. You won't do it because you have to. You will do it because the love of Christ is in your heart. You cannot separate your personal beliefs from the actions that flow from them. If you believe, you will act. You will act upon what you believe is true. You will do your value system. You always do your value system. And when you do something that's evil and you think, "Why did I do that?" You did it because you love it. And when you do a good thing, you think, "Wow, that's Christ working in me." Yep, it is Christ working in you, but he's changed you to make you love the good as well. Your actions reveal whose kingdom you're in. Many Christians mistakenly believe that Jesus' kingdom is some future event for them. Instead, they need to realize they're in Christ's kingdom right now. And we're expected to expand his kingdom by helping others enter it and by sacrificially loving all those who are in it, who are in need. The kingdoms of men will go on in conflict and turmoil. And Jesus says, in the midst of all that, while we wait, we are to live in his kingdom in a different way, something that doesn't work in the kingdoms of the world. Oh Lord, we thank you that you are the king of your beautiful kingdom that you established through your death and resurrection. That you've brought us into it. You call us to love one another in it now. Regardless of what's happening in the world around us, we're to love all those in the kingdom in a special and beautiful way as a testimony to all nations that the good news of Christ has come to us. Help us be faithful to do that until you're coming. Amen.